Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, David Deere
and Donald Dalton.
This episode, we are going to discuss a metaphysical concept that is often heard in the metaphysical communities, which is the concept of as above, so below. And I came up with this idea for a topic based on something that Donald had said in the episode when we talked about sin. No, actually, it was in the episode when we talked about negative entities.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, Donald, I'm going to paraphrase, so forgive me on this, but you had basically said, I had said in that episode that when the negative entities are out there, blah, 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 you know, attachments and all that other stuff, you had said, actually, they're in there.
Oh.
Do you remember that?
I totally do, yes.
Okay. My take on that was that you were referring and basing that statement on the idea of as above, so below, as within, so without. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to ask you, what when you said that, where did you get that concept of? What do you base that particular statement on?
During the recording, I originally based that concept on the whole idea of, you know, everything comes from within, because if it comes from within, then it's you're still being empowered. But once you start giving your power away and saying it comes from without, outside of you, you're basically giving your power away, and you don't have a lot that you can do with it. And so the idea is everything that is, that you experience and see and everything, to a large degree, especially when we were talking about negative energies and negative entities, does, I believe, come within, except originally from within, like we talked about in that episode, where if you create an environment for negative energies and entities to reside, you know, you make them a little bachelor pad or bachelorette pad, and, you know, put in a big screen TV and plenty of drinks and, you know, stuff in the refrigerator, they're going to feel more invited to, you know, attach themselves to. And I think that's what it was more specifically, where you're creating an environment to allow that negative energy or negative entity to feel at home within you.
Okay, so not to get too stuck on the negative entities conversation, because we already had a whole episode on this.
Yeah.
If the negative entities can feel more at home, then where are they coming from? And if you're saying the environment that's created is an environment within, is an internal environment, then where are they coming from? Were they always there and just buried? Or were they actually, did they actually kind of escalate and take form from nowhere?
That's a good question. You know, I'm going to hold fast to my whole idea that everything comes from within. And if you're making a place that's a nice, inviting place for a negative entity, then what you're doing is basically creating a place for your, like, imaginary friend. Not a happy one or anything, but, you know, children create imaginary friends, but that's all from within, yet they perceive them as from, outside. They attribute it to an object or something like that. And I think it's along the same lines as that, where it's an internal manifestation that is projected outside coming in, as opposed to from inside going out. Okay. And I think that's, I know that sounds, saying that in my head and hearing what I'm saying, it sounds a little confusing, but hopefully that makes a little more sense.
Well, what are your thoughts on this? The idea as above, so below, and as within, so without, is that everything external, and you're talking about boats and trees and cars and other people and fish, are projections from an inner landscape, from something within. And the heavens, as above, so below. In other words, the heavens and all the energies outside ourselves and galaxies and solar systems are the cosmos is a reflection of just basically our earthly experience. As above, so below, it's kind of deceiving, because it says it's a reflection. And a reflection is a deception, because it looks like you're looking at two different things just on a mirror, you see. But they're actually the same thing. And I think that's the whole idea behind the statement as above, so below. And do you give credence to that concept? Or is it just kind of ethereal woo-woo talk?
It is a very complex question to answer. and I'll explain a little bit why. It's because one part of me says it's, you know, just philosophical mumbo-jumbo hoo-boo-doo-boo-boo-doo. It just sounds nice for people. But on the other hand, I can also see that things happen in levels. For example, maybe what's above is same as what's below, just in a slightly different experience or different level. Whereas if I take you out of where you're at right now, and I put you in any random house anywhere in that is functioning anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world that in like the Western world, you are familiar with that's a sink. Sink is where we get water from. Oh, that's the latrine. That's the bathroom. That's where we go to the bathroom, and that's where, you know, we probably bathe. You know, this is the kitchen. That's where we prepare food. Well, even though you're in a different house or in a different place in a different state, there's still things that are the same. And I think it's kind of similar to that from, you know, where we are right here on a third dimensional plane. Things are a certain way that we understand. And if we go up to as above, as it were, things are still there. They're just experienced slightly differently. In other words, instead of being in a house, let's say you're on a plane. Well, we know that a plane is not a living facility, but we know that planes have bathrooms, and we know that what bathrooms are used for. And we know that a plane has seats, and we know what seats are used for. And does that make sense?
I think so. I think I know what you're trying to say. Here's what I understand what you're trying to say. You're trying to say that basically no matter where you go, there are similar structures between one thing and another. And if you're going up a dimension, for example, I'm assuming that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
When you go up into a higher dimension, you're going to find that the framework is very similar to this dimension, but just slightly different. Like, for example, being on a 747 versus a DC-3.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's just different levels of, you know, what is continually the same and which things are different. Because there, you know, if you go, let's say you go up one level, per se, and this is just examples. That's like going to a different apartment or a different house, a different living thing. Still very similar. You're able to make your way around. The floor plan probably a little different. Neighbors a little different. The view outside the window is different, but everything is still functional. You go up, let's say another 2, 3, 4 levels, then that's like being in, let's say, an amusement park where things are much different. There isn't necessarily one place just to live, but the view is very interesting depending on which amusement park you're at. Food, you're still able to get food, but instead of having a kitchen where you prepare it, it's prepared for you and you just have to exchange money for it. And I think there's that similarity that goes through all levels. It just changes a little bit where, you know, the idea is food is still food and you still need to eat. It's just the way that you get food from outside to inside is slightly different, and the view might be a little bit different as well.
Okay. Well, see, I think it's kind of interesting. I think that it's a through the looking glass thing for me. That it's like, I say through the looking glasses because I used the analogy of a mirror before.
Mm-hmm.
And you and the reflection of you in the mirror move simultaneously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though you can't really touch if you touch the mirror, you're not really touching your cheek when you see it. And to me, it's like a through the looking glass thing where basically you can actually move through the looking glass. And when you find yourself on the other side, you realize that you were on the same side. It's like a Mobius strip in a way, if that makes any sense. I hearken back to the episode where we talked about, it was an episode I referenced recently. Just a conversation between you and me. I'm trying to remember what it was. And, well, I mean, there's nonlinear creation theory, and there's all sorts of other episodes where we talk about a microcosm and a macrocosm, that basically everything is And then also the episode where we talked about external symbolization of symbolism.
Yeah.
And now all that stuff there is it makes me think that they say that life is an illusion. Do you buy into that?
No.
Okay. And why is that?
Because reality is based on your perception of what you choose to observe.
Reality is based on your perception of what you choose to deserve, to observe.
Yeah. In other words,
if
I choose, my reality is that I choose to observe this computer that I'm on right now, that I'm using to communicate with you across the country. And that's what I'm observing. Therefore, it's my reality. And that's my perception that I choose to observe. Therefore, it's my reality.
Well, if you're choosing to observe a specific perception, then it's pretty much just malleable and it's just clay without form, isn't it? So is the clay reality or is the form that it takes reality? But if you're choosing it, how real is it? Isn't it just a moving target? Isn't it just this constantly changing thing that really doesn't have any definition, that doesn't really have any true substance?
Okay, so in a stage magician is all about illusion. When they make a card disappear from their hands and it's all of a sudden it's gone, did the card really ever exist? And we just they were just able to show us an illusion of a card? Or did the card exist and through sleight of hand now it's not being able to be perceived? We're not able to see it.
So you're using the idea that the card is always there.
The card is always there, and the card, I would say, you know, when you're watching a stage magician, the card is real. It's just what the magician, what we do with the card that makes it whether we see it as an illusion or not there altogether.
So what I understand you're saying is that if it's an illusion, there is a reality to it that is deceptive.
No.
That it's not truly represented.
No, it's not an illusion. It's real as long as we're able to perceive it. In other words, as long as we're able to perceive that card that the magician on the stage is holding, then for all intents and purposes, to us, that card is real.
And then when he makes it disappear?
Then the card...
Or change?
The card is still there, but we no longer are able to perceive it. But our intellect knows that the game that the magician plays is a sleight of hand, and therefore if we change our perception a little bit, if we use our intellect to a degree, our intellect is able to perceive the idea that the card is still there, because the magic that a stage magician does and the magic that a sorcerer does are two different things. And
what's a magic a sorcerer does?
A magic a sorcerer does can actually make the card disappear into thin air, and actually the card is gone.
A real sorcerer?
Yes.
You mean? Or are you talking about like a Harry Potter sorcerer?
Yes. Someone who is able to do a magic to the extreme, like magic.
With a K. Magic with
a K.
Do you believe that there are people that are capable of doing that?
In the way that we've been seeing through stories and media?
Well, if you're going to use it as an example, we can't talk about Harry Potter in this context if we don't subscribe any substance or reality to Harry Potter. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
So if you're going to use the sorcerer example, you've got to back it up by either confirming that, yes, we do have sorcerers do have the capability to do this and that they are real, or I believe they can be real, or we have to kind of dispense with it.
I'm going to say, as most images of sorcerers are presented in modern day stories and TV and movies, then no.
I'm not talking about the guy with the white beard and all that other stuff. I'm asking you, do you believe that there are people in this world that can, in quotes, make a card literally disappear?
Into thin air.
Yes.
Not on them in any way, shape, or form, not up their sleeve, just literally the atoms disintegrate and the card is no longer a card.
Right.
No.
So we got to throw that out. we can't talk about the sorcerers then. Yeah. Because we are talking about what's an illusion versus what's real.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought up the idea of Harry Potter. And because, okay, the interesting thing about that is whenever you read a story, is the story an illusion or is the story real?
That depends. I think you're asking the same thing as when you're watching a magician with a card.
I know.
It's really a similar question.
Exactly. I'm just explaining it a little different way because because the story is not real until you perceive it, and you perceive it by reading it. And what happens is it gets into your brain. Your thoughts create this imaginary attributes to the characters and what they look like, the body language, all this kind of stuff like that. And then your brain is able to create the story inside your imagination. Whereas, and along the same lines, a movie, you know, not so much imagination. You're basically just, it's a story that you're passively following along with. But any one of the Harry Potter movies an illusion? No, it's real. There were real people that performed a real story, acted out a real story, therefore, and then put it on a real format so that you could see it in a real physical place. But the story itself never really happened outside of fiction.
Well, there are people who believe that when you create a very well and detailed fiction, that sometimes, rather than creating, you are actually pulling from an alternate reality.
Oh, see, this goes back to our other episodes of multiverse and alternate realities.
Right, yeah. But here's where I want to take this.
Okay.
Since we're talking about this whole idea of when it becomes a reality or when it doesn't become a reality, trying to determine, and I want to get to, well, I have to kind of go into the whole reality thing that we like to talk about to a degree, but if there is a Harry Potter universe.
Okay. And there is.
And there is. Or let's even do this. Let's talk about something that's part of our reality, which is the computer, right? We have these computers that can do some amazing things. Where did the concept of the computer come from? The concept of the computer came from lots of other concepts.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the concept of electronics came from the idea that you could take these little electric bits and switch them on and off and write a language that kind of dictated which way it went. And then you had electricity had to be discovered in order to, we had to keep discovering all these things, right?
Yeah. They actually have a mechanical computer that I think somebody, I can't remember the name, came up with and created like back in the late 1800s.
Is this computer, are current computers based on that one?
I believe so. It's based on a yes or no type computing.
And what was the one in the 1800s based on?
No, that's what it was. But it was all gears and shifts and levers and stuff, instead of electronic tubes and that's run on electricity. It was all mechanical.
Okay. So now, but that, here's what I'm asking, that mechanical computer, what was that based on?
Somebody wanted to, probably an abacus.
Maybe. And what was the abacus based on? You see, I'm going to keep going until we get to some zero point.
Probably somebody's fingers or pebbles.
Right. And then I can go with what's the fingers based on. But see, what I'm saying is that all the human mystery and wonder that we have today, all the modern inventions and all the concepts and all the fiction that we create seems to be based, I mean, empirical evidence and logical reason and thought likes to say that all these things were based on something that preceded it,
mm-hmm.
on a predecessor of some sort. And each of those things kind of evolved from one from the next as we kind of started making it more complex. I'm saying, did they? I'm saying that eventually if you trace it far back enough, you're going to come from nothing. I mean, the whole concept of the Big Bang is what? That everything was compressed in this little tiny, you know, ultra tiny space and just wanted to explode? Where does it go before that? So what I'm saying is that everything seems to come from nothing. And that's the whole idea of the principle. When people talk about as above, so below, what they're saying is that everything that we've created has already been created, has never been created, has always been there and never been there. It's a paradox.
Mm-hmm.
That everything comes from nothing, and that everything, all everything is just a little tiny microcosm. Every single atom contains the entire universe. And it's not just that everything in the world makes up, you know, all that is. It's not just so simple as that. It's saying that if you sliced anything open, you're going to find the sum total of the universe within every single thing. And that's the idea of the as above, so below. One of my favorite movies. Are you familiar with, I've asked you this before. Did you ever see Last Temptation of Christ?
No, that's one I don't care to see.
Why?
Gory details at the end.
No, you're thinking of Passion of the Christ.
Oh.
Two different movies.
Okay. No, I haven't seen that one either.
Okay. I have not seen Passion of the Christ, and I don't have any interest in seeing it. Last Temptation of the Christ is it's written by Nikos Kazantzakis, and it's a whole idea of that Jesus the Christ had to experience humanity. He also had to experience all the temptations that went with humanity. He was constantly coming to crossroads. And then the ultimate crossroads he came to is, am I going to die up here or am I going to live life as a mortal man?
Mm-hmm.
And it was played by Willem Dafoe. And he was talking to somebody once, and he says, when I look into the shiny black eye of an ant, I see God. And I think that's what he was saying in that quote in that movie. He was saying that basically, I could see the sum total of the universe and beyond in that eye. And I see that in everything. And it was maddening. Could you imagine if you saw the blueprint of the entire cosmos and the construction and architecture of the entire cosmos in every little thing that you looked at?
Yeah, it would be a little bit maddening.
It would be maddening, exactly. However, I think that's the whole concept, as above, so below. How do we wrap our minds around that?
I don't know. Can we actually wrap our minds around that?
That's what this show's for.
I mean,
that's what we try to do.
Yeah, because we have our experience of what we term reality, the real world. And then anything beyond that, we have to use our imagination of what it could be or what it might be like.
Well, how do we know that a reality is not a collective? It's like I always say, the consensus reality, that we've all agreed of what the structure of the sandbox is going to be, and then we all jump in and play by this sandbox construction that we've all agreed upon. Like, for example, if we're sitting there daydreaming in our head and we're saying, I wonder what it would have been like to be a pilot. And we're just imagining that, and then the imagination ends, and we're back sitting in our chair looking out the window, for example. That's what we were doing before the imagination, and now that's what we're doing after the imagination. So we say, well, we're just having a daydream or a fantasy when we're dreaming about being a pilot, but then we're up, come back to reality is the old quote, come back to reality. But to me, the reality is tied to what, a flesh and blood experience? How do we know that the flesh and blood experience isn't a construct that all of human consciousness agreed to make the illusion, to make the giant daydream and play in it? And because we're all projecting this mass reality construct, that it is real.
Yeah, that goes along the whole thing of, I once dreamed that I was a butterfly, but then I was wondering if I was a butterfly dreaming I was a man, or if I was a man dreaming I was a butterfly.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, are we the dreamer or are we the dreamed? And, you know, that goes so much into what is, back to the episodes when we've talked about reality, is because what is reality? And reality, if it is what it is, like what you're talking about, where we all take turns in the sandbox trying out different costumes, different lifetimes, different experiences, then is what is above the same as so below? And are there actually higher levels than what we're talking about? Or are we the whole universe contained in our consciousness traveling in our little meatbag cars?
Yeah, are we actually just living these rules of physics that we created in order to have a specific type of experience? And here's what's interesting about reality and the playground in which we play. I got to throw out a couple of concepts that I came across that I'm still just like, wow, these kind of blow my mind.
Okay.
I don't know how much you've ever listened to people who have, this is a great one, have worked with extraterrestrial technology or extraterrestrials.
Oh, no, not a lot. I don't believe I've talked to anyone face-to-face or personally.
Well, even so, there's,
have you?
I have not talked to anyone face-to-face, but I've listened to the different interviews with people.
Gotcha.
And there's an interview I'm thinking of specifically with a gentleman, and I don't remember the name of the book he wrote, but I'm going to put it in the show notes. But he was on it's a podcast called the Something Universe. I wish I could remember what it was called. I will also put that in the show notes, so forgive me. Go to our website and look if you want to know what podcast I'm talking about or show I'm talking about. It's a couple of guys out of Australia. It's like Amazing Universe or something, or Unexplained Universe or something. And I'll put it in the show notes, but they were interviewing a guy who did research on technology, alien technology, and there was a guy who had worked with all these crafts, the Area 51 stuff and alien technology and all this other stuff. They'd asked this one guy, what's the deal on alien travel, space travel, and UFOs and how they and their propulsion system? And the guy says, okay, do you know the whole idea behind quantum mechanics that all things reside in one place simultaneously? And they said yes. And they're like, there you go. And he left. So, and there's other ideas that the crafts that are made that they researched, there's an understanding given about the technology, that the technology is not, that our technology is destructive technology. We destroy to create. We basically deconstruct something to construct another thing, mm-hmm. where the alien technology is organic. People have said that they've been in these crafts or they've studied these materials and there's no seams. It's all seamless. They can't tell where things are joined together. That's because they're not joined together. They're basically formed. They're formed on an organic level where basically the atomic structure is taken and rearranged on a very psychic manipulative level. In fact, they use that same idea of the construction of the walls at, is it Nazca or Cusco or, and the Egyptian pyramids? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
There's these walls in, I don't know if it's in Machu Picchu. I don't know. It's in South America. I can't remember which walls there are. But if you look at the walls, you cannot fit a hair in between these giant stones. And the fact that the stones, much like the Egyptian pyramids, came from a long ways away, like, you know, several miles. And not to mention, they have these artifacts where they're showing a perfectly bored hole. The circumference of the hole is even throughout a stone from one side to the other. And there's no chisel marks or anything like that. It's this clean, perfect, cylindrical, bored hole going through. Which is granite. I don't know what kind of rock it is. And the idea behind that, again, is that they've taken the molecular structure and rearranged it to be able to change the stone to fit together this way, as they do on this wall and as they do on the Great Pyramids.
So putting it in a different way, it's almost like they hacked in with a computer into the atoms and electrons of stone and basically said, we want you to resemble this picture, and send the picture to the cells of the stone, and then basically just wait until the stone becomes that thing.
Right. Yeah.
See, that's a concept that is that's so foreign to our understanding of how things work at the moment.
It is, but we kind of do that in ways.
Oh, really? Okay, you got to tell me, how do we do that in ways?
Well, like I've said before, if somebody found a USB thumb drive 5,000 years from now and there was no electricity, it would mean nothing to them. But there would be these ancient legends that entire volumes of knowledge were stored in misshapen silicones of sand.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Aren't we in essence doing the same thing? And then if you look at the pyramids, I mean, our modern technology in 5,000 or 10,000 or 20,000, however long you believe the age of the pyramids are, could be seen the same way as, we don't know how they stored all this knowledge in these silicone crystals, but they did. You know, we say this about the Egyptians. We don't really know how they built the pyramids, but they, you know.
We assume that they did.
Exactly. I think that they tapped into not the laws of a universe. They realized how they could alter the laws of the universe, because they realized if the universe is embedded within our consciousness as it is, that means we've got full reign.
That would be the same idea of what we're talking about when we say as above, where there's more of this instant manifestation, you know, as below, the possibility of it still happening where we can instantly manifest. It just takes a little bit longer.
Yeah. Or if it takes, yeah, exactly. It does take a little bit longer. We do watch things change shape and form over time. And if you are going in an extremely fast machine, or if you watch time-lapse photography, things seem to kind of change in minutes.
Mm-hmm. So basically, as above, so below is true. As long as
I believe so. Are you not sure about it necessarily?
No, I agree with you too. It just sounded like for a moment there, throughout the, there might have been a little bit of doubt based on what we conceived as, or what we perceived as reality or non-reality. Mm-hmm. Because if we perceive reality on a higher level from our current state, it'll look a lot different than if we were on a higher level experiencing a higher level reality.
Kind of like what you said earlier about living in houses.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly, yeah. But I think that's what our holdback is that we have created these self-perceived limits on ourselves. So as a result, they become very real, in quotes. And as a result, we're stuck to that. I don't know if we've said this in another podcast, but it's that, I'm going to paraphrase that Abraham Hicks quote, which is basically somebody had asked something, if we're able to do anything just based on our belief, why can't we just grow a severed arm back? And they said, because you don't believe you can. And that seems like too simple of an answer. And I think that was the whole analogy. I don't want to say that Christ quoted it, because we don't know if he said it. But I think the idea behind the quote, that if, with faith you can move a mountain, I think that's what that meant. It meant that if you believe inherently, if you know that you can alter reality, then you can. But it just has to be that absolute certainty of the universe contained within you.
And see, it's kind of interesting you bring that up, because I actually saw a picture on Facebook today that one of my friends posted, where it showed this guy, and I can't remember what country he's in, but he basically, over 22 years, moved a mountain.
Okay, how did he do that?
I think probably one stone at a time. But he basically made it so there was a path through the mountain, so to, from where his village or city was to the next major medical center, the next major hospital, instead of that way, instead of people having to go, I think in the picture it said 70 kilometers to get to the hospital from that village, they were able to get down in just a few kilometers, because they were able to do a straight line right there. Now, it's kind of interesting, because you were saying that, you know, if you have enough belief, you can move a mountain. It didn't say you can move a mountain instantly. There's this time factor here. And that's what kind of made me think about that, is because this guy, you know, did 22 years of meticulous, you know, constantly moving mountain one at a time, piece by piece. And
physically, I mean, he actually carried pieces.
Yeah, he physically moved he physically moved it.
Well, here, let me ask you this then.
Okay.
You made me think of this. If we say that we've agreed to play in physical reality, so we're kind of constrained to the acceptance of the limits of physical reality. If our consciousness in, let's say, you and me living in this consensual reality, if we're living in consensus reality and we all of a sudden find that we are able to manipulate reality based on the idea that we know how to manipulate reality, you almost have to see the illusion of it. You know what I'm saying?
No. What do you mean see the illusion of it?
Okay. If physical reality is malleable,
okay,
like if alien technology is based on basically being able to shape stones and move stones, entire stones, to just be able to cut them physically out of a riverbed or a quarry or something like that, physically just separate that that stone in that specific shape and transport it to some building site, some ancient building site. Let's say that's an ancient alien technology, right?
Okay.
Okay. Now, if you're either the aliens or the indigenous people that are oohing and aahing that the aliens can do this, then both of those parties have accepted that as a possibility within this reality.
Okay.
Now, if I could grow my arm from nothing, like it's like the whole Abraham idea from Esther and Jerry Hicks says, we can't regrow a limb because we don't believe we can regrow. If we did believe we could regrow a limb to the extent that we actually can regrow a limb, doesn't that mean we would have a perception of reality that is able to play with the laws of physics loosely?
Well, definitely our own physical body.
Well, at least that, if not anything else. And if that's the case, then would our perception be a little bit skewed to where we would seem almost insane to other people? If we truly subscribe to the idea that we are the creators of our own reality, and you have somebody who says, I can manipulate reality because I know that I understand that I am a blueprint of the universe,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I'm able to manipulate my own reality to a great degree, to the degree of aliens reshaping stones and all that other stuff. My question is this. If we have the perception to know that we can do this, to know we can regrow a limb or whatever you want to say, would that perception skew our reality enough to where we would see the world askew and people might see us as a little bit insane?
Yeah, probably. If we were able to do that in our, you know, in this three-dimensional reality, then yeah, I think there would. But we hear things like that all the time, where we have people that are able to do amazing things, like read with their feet, or you know, eat glass, or have electricity go through them at enormous that would normally kill a normal person. And you know, that happens, and it's been documented. So if we say, oh, you know, we're able, we can regrow limbs. Here's my hand. Cut it off. Give me 3 weeks. There it is. You know, then yeah, we're gonna seem a little odd. But at the same time, let's say we go back 2,000-3,000 years, or yeah, I don't know how many thousand years we have. Maybe just 1,000 years, maybe two. And we say, you know, I can take eggs, flour, sugar, and milk, and create a thing called a cake. And they're like, what's a cake? We spend a few hours, we bring the cake out, and we say, eat. And like, oh, this is really good. How did you do this? And like, it's a secret. Well, see, they already know that that it was prepared. I think it's a level of how far away from what the mass consensus observes or perceives as being possible in this reality that we're able to go to. If, let's say, 51% of the whole world had this belief that we could regrow limbs, then probably we would be able to. We would definitely be able to.
What you're talking about is a 100th monkey idea, or there's a term for it, actually. It's when you reach critical mass. That's the term. So what you're saying is that there's a specific critical mass in a human belief to be able to alter our reality.
I'm saying that that's one way to do it.
Now, here's my question for you, and this ties a little bit into the guy who's crazy because he can do all these things. Can we alter or learn how to alter our reality on an individual level outside of reaching critical mass?
And see, that's the other thing. I think what we have to be shown to some degree that it's possible in one way or another. either through a story, in a dream, or by a mentor. If we are able to see that it's actually possible, we are already making that shift from that's not possible to it is possible, and therefore it's becoming a belief and becoming a reality that we, in our perception that we observed, and therefore literally a reality.
But you just said it has to be introduced to from outside ourselves.
Yeah. Well, okay.
If everything is inside, like you said about the negative entities, how could we have something introduced from outside ourselves?
And this goes back to what you said, you know, what you were talking about earlier. What is the original thought? What is the original idea, the original perception? Who was the first person that said, oh, we can regrow limbs, or observed that that was even remotely a possibility? Somebody somewhere had to have that thought and then passed it down.
And where did the thought come from?
Probably observing the reality where they saw a lizard and the lizard regrew its tail. And it's like, oh, that's different. His tail was gone. Thought he'd be gone for the rest of his life. Now it's back.
What about computer technology? What aspect of nature did we observe to come up with that?
That, I think, was built on hundreds upon thousands of ideas of calculations of, hey, how do we if we do this and then do this, then, you know, let's make an abacus that is like on steroids. Okay, now we've made an abacus that's on steroids. Ooh, what's this electricity thing? Let's put that in there. Well, electricity can only be on or off, so let's create this whole computer that is based on either a switch being on or a switch being off, and each one of those switches does a different thing, and in combination with each other they can do more stuff. The idea is seeing what's out there and bringing it in. It's kind of like, think of it this way: if you've never heard the sound of a guitar before, how can you write music for a guitar?
See, I would venture to say that I think you were more right in the negative entities episode when you said that the entities, I don't know why you're saying the entities are inside, but the great things are out. See, here's, okay.
No, okay. The thought has to come from somewhere. And the thought can come from somewhere.
No, it doesn't have to come from somewhere. It can just come from nowhere.
You don't just all of a sudden get a thought and go, oh, I'm intelligent now. Woohoo. That doesn't happen.
No. See, okay. I'm not explaining it very well.
Okay.
So, have you ever heard about the idea of the guy who came up with the model for the octane molecule?
The what molecule?
Octane.
Oh, for like gasoline?
Yeah.
No.
Octane is a ring, basically. It is these hydrocarbon based molecules that form a specific ring, which helps to create the molecular structure that allows it to react the way it does.
Okay.
And the guy who came up with this had a dream. And in the dream, he had a dream of a snake eating its own tail.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I'm telling this story right. I tell a lot of stories on here and I never know if they're right. But that's my understanding of there's a lot of these guys in science that have these dreams, these concepts that came to them in dreams. And the thing is now you go into like a Native American culture, and I'm talking about even modern or versus early Native American cultures, where they will see animals, literally see an animal, and that animal will have a meaning. Like, for example, the Navajos call the coyote is a great, it's a trickster, it's a teacher, it is a very sacred and revered animal in the Navajo ideologies. And if you see a coyote at some point in your life, that means there is going to be great change. They've said it consistently. They've said whenever we've seen a coyote in our life, there has been absolute significant change in our life, in our experience. Of course, you and I don't have that necessarily. Why is that? Does coyote mean great change if you're a Navajo, or does it mean great change, period? And the thing about it is that to me is a symbolism that has arisen from their internal landscape, from their internal society and culture and belief system, and it manifests into the reality out there. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where we see a coyote and we're like, oh, God, now we got to lock up the chicken coop and we got to put our small dogs and cats away. So it's a playing together. It doesn't come from nowhere. I think it's us trying to figure out how the universe creates, and what we do is we just translate it into our own, into something we can understand.
But the thing is, I believe that the first person to make that connection between coyote and, you know, great change, you know, was keeping track of things that happened in their life, and all of a sudden realized, hey, you know what? Every time something big happens, my life goes off into a different way that I never conceived of before. Coyote's always there. Oh.
I don't think so. I don't agree.
Oh, you don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I think the Native Americans lived so ingrained and in touch with the environment that they understood and felt the currents of the way nature flowed and worked. And I think they felt the way coyote operated within that current. And when I say they felt it, it's because they recognized themselves as an integral part of this nature, to the degree of knowing that one was the creator of the other, that they co-created. And the thing is to really understand the as above, so below, we can't use concepts of, oh yeah, well, they observed it and they realized it, because we're talking about above and below is a very, very paradoxical concept. And I really think to embrace the concept of as above, so below, as within, so without, we have to embrace the paradox. We can't try to explain it in, well, it is which came first, chicken and the egg, and you have to basically say they both came first, and then you can proceed from there. But when you try to reason it out and say, well, it actually would be the chicken because of this, and we actually observe nature doing this, and that's how we concepted it, rather than believe, like you said, are we the dreamer or are we the dream? And when you could say yes to that question, then we really are starting to understand the concept of as above and so below. We are the Escher, I've said it before, we're the Escher drawing of the hand, drawing the hand, drawing the hand.
We are the eternal Mandelbrot fractal.
Exactly. We are the eternal Mandelbrot fractal.
But the fractal is based on a mathematical concept or a mathematical series that is infinite. And when you see that in nature and everything, you have an understanding that, oh, you can see that mathematical concept, and now we've put it on the computer and everything. I still, me personally, I have to lean way more to the more pragmatic way of thinking, where it's like, okay, so David, you're telling me that the first Navajo back way, 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 way back, all of a sudden that there was, they had a tribe, and one guy or one Navajo said to the other, like, coyote, he's a trickster. Big changes come when coyote comes around. And everyone's like, yeah, you're right, he does. Or was it more of just like, oh, I saw a coyote today, and everyone's like, oh, stuff's going to happen. Are you saying that that is more realistic than observational, where people where they saw that, oh, major things happened in our tribe when we looked at what animals were around us, because we believe nature tells us and gives us messages of things that are there. We noticed that coyote was there at every time, so therefore we associate coyote with the massive change.
I would say, yeah, that makes more sense to me. It's like I was listening to a podcast of Psychic Access, Psychic View, Viewpoint. Psychic Access Radio. Basically, they had a guest on there, and he spoke to plants. He communicated with plants, and he talked about indigenous people and how they communicate to plants. And they were saying, well, how did they know? How did they find? Did they do trial and error of how to communicate with the plants? And they said, no, the plant told them. The plant told them what the plant was good to be used for. In a conversation, if somebody's talking, you need somebody to listen to be able to have a conversation. So there's no conversation without a talker and a listener.
Well, yeah, that's basic communication 101 right there.
So which came first, the talker or the listener? So what I'm saying here is that if the shaman, for example, said, oh, well, the plant told me, who's the plant going to tell? Only the person that can understand the language of the plant. You see what I'm saying? The plant always knew what was good for the human being, but didn't until the human being came along and didn't until the plant came along. They had to coexist and co-reside in that, in their own properties, and kind of meet in the middle. It's always meeting in the middle. And that's what above so below means, is that you meet in the middle, and the middle is where everything happens. You look at the Mandelbrot fractal and you say, well, this is a little version of the big version, but the little version has its own way of doing, of being, and the big version has its own way of being. But you're like, yeah, but they kind of look the same at a distance. You can't really tell one or the other. That's what I think it means, as above, so below. That's the paradox of, yes, the dreamer and the dream. Dreamer, the dream is the dreamer dreaming the dream, or the chicken and the egg both came first. And, oh, wait, let me add some last piece to that. Because you talk about the whole science thing. You know, you have to talk about the, well, empirical evidence and validation. Well, science, they're setting their own rules as well. I mean, think about the TED Talks things that have gone on. You remember the whole TED Talks with Rupert Sheldrake and Grant Hancock? They were basically saying, all right, well, here, we consider this science. And they're like, no, it's not science. Why? Because you're not playing by science's rules. And they're like, well, maybe science needs to change its rules to stretch and allow this in. And science is going, no, no, we don't. No, we don't. No, we don't. So it's like, that's what I'm saying, is that it's a self-creating cage is what it is. And I think that when we're saying, well, we have to figure out what came first. We have to figure out if the coyote was there first, or if the concept of the Navajo's idea of what the coyote means came first. When we do that, I think we're painting ourselves in a corner, which I think that science is amazing, and science created this framework that has created literally so many fantastic things, but I think it's going to run out of room because it won't stretch outside of its box, because it keeps saying something has to come before something else.
But as above, so below, so therefore science has to be also applied and work on a higher level as well as a lower level.
Explain that.
Well, okay. If things are pretty much similar on a higher level and here and then on a lower level, then science works really well here. Science will then have to work fairly well on a higher level.
But could it work on all levels?
Well, that's the thing, though. It says as above, so below. It didn't say as above, so below, except for levels 2 through 5 and, you know, maybe number 12.
So you're basically saying that because science works on this level, that it works on all levels?
Well, if you find that as above, so below doesn't work in one thing, is it possible that it doesn't work in everything?
Okay, give me an example of that. I'm not following the point.
The whole basic idea is, let's say we have dimensions and levels 1 through 12, and we're on level 3. We're on the third dimension, and science works fairly well for most things on the third dimension. Well, if the idea of as above, so below is to be believed, then since science works here on the third, it should also work on the fourth, fifth, and all the way up to the 12th.
No, because science is only based on third.
Really?
So, yeah, in my opinion.
The whole idea of electricity is based on science, or we've learned how to use electricity based on science.
We have the rules of electricity, but we don't understand completely the rules of electricity.
Doesn't matter if we understand the rules of electricity. We've been able to harness it and make it work for us.
Is electricity at all unpredictable?
Well, yeah, it is.
Yeah, and science doesn't like unpredictability.
But we know that the nature of electricity is unpredictable, and we know fairly to a fairly good degree how to contain it and make it work for us so that its unpredictability is not unsafe.
Well, but that's not electricity working by the rules of science. That's science working by, you know, they're picking and choosing what they want to work with. They're like, well, the unpredictability, we're not going to deal with that. Science is all about predictability. Science is basically saying, empirical evidence says basically that this works as long as you can reproduce the same results over and over and over again. So what they do is they say, what you do is make sure that the conditions are set to where they can do this consistently.
Exactly.
And if it varies once, now here's the thing about that. In what world where things constantly change are the conditions consistent? That's my problem with science, is that science says, let's control a little lab experiment. life doesn't work like a lab experiment. Tell me that if you take the same road at the same speed at the same time of day every single day, that you getting to work at the exact same time is perfect.
Well, of course not.
And then, and they say no, because science says no, because you're factoring in too many variables. I'm like, but that's life. Life is factoring in too many variables. There's no clinical little box that you can walk around in life, and science tries to do that. So science works really well if you can control all the elements. And science says, you know, we don't work with the random variables. We don't like those, the unpredictables. We don't work with those. That's not science.
So taking that whole idea that you were talking with the driving to work, if I took the laptop that I have and I went back 400 years and I turned it on with just the battery, I'd be able to use it and it would work for a few hours in a different place. If I took it 400 years into the future with just the battery and I turned it on, it's pretty likely that it'd still work for a few hours. The technology,
I don't know. Well, I'm not sure if it would.
Well, see, that's the thing, though. That's what I'm saying, is with science that we've observed, we can see all this stuff that has happened, and we know how science works, and we know how to manipulate the ideas of science and mathematics and everything to explain how things work. And if we're able to do that, and if we're able to explain how things work, and they follow these ideas here, then they have to follow them on higher levels.
Well, not necessarily. Let's use the laptop analogy.
Okay. Before you do that, does energy equal mass times the square of the speed of light?
They're thinking it's iffy.
Oh,
really? They're
thinking
that's not necessarily. Oh, yeah.
I haven't heard of that.
Oh, yeah, because you're going into quantum physics. That then the laws start to get a little rough.
Okay.
And unpredictable.
All right, go ahead with your laptop.
You said if you take a laptop 500 years into the past, 400 years into the past, and you have a good charged battery and you power it on, that's going to work. You don't know that. You don't know that. You don't know that 400 years ago, there may have been enough variations in just the fabric work of reality that the laptop is contingent on the mass acceptance of the fabric of this reality, that if you go back 400 years, the laptop cannot work because the framework is not in place at that point in time.
Oh, okay. This is kind of like the whole idea with the mass consciousness believing that we can grow limbs that we were talking about earlier.
Kind of, sort of, yeah, exactly. And the thing is I think it's different because when we're talking about technology, I think technology is a slave to science as a result. So what happens is when you try to take technology, now we're talking time travel and... So it's, I think that you standard technology is not going to do well as far as time travel goes. I think it could work, but I also think it couldn't work. I think it might be a little mistaken and premature to say that it would work for sure, because science is contingent on the framework to work within the framework of the rules that we've set. Now we're stepping outside of the framework of the rules that we've set, which is modern day acceptance of how things work. I mean, because people could do amazing things with bricks and stones that we can't do anymore because we don't have the understanding of that anymore. Now, is it because we don't know how to do it, or is it because the reality shifted? Did a magnetic shift it? You know, there's a thousand ways that things could be different to have sabotaged the functioning of ancient technology. Ancient technology itself may be contingent on the reality in which we are. So with the as above, so below idea, that's basically saying that the technology of science works in the realm of science because it's three-dimensionally dependent to a degree. When we go into quantum, when we start using quantum computers, I think that for quantum technology to truly work effectively in a mind-blowing way, we're going to have to change what we consider science. And then what are we doing? We're playing with the laws of reality that we understand are malleable, that we don't necessarily think are now.
And you actually did not go as far as what you were saying right there, where you were saying that the tools that we've created, such as computers and our electronics through our science, work in the reality that in 3D reality. And I would add on to that, from what you were saying before, that in our 3D reality as we at right now at this current time, me personally, I still believe that if you take a laptop back 400 years into the past or into the future, it's going to work, because laws of physics say if it has charge and it has electricity and it has a source of power, it should work.
Also, laws of physics say that you should not be able to move those stones from a quarry hundreds of miles or several miles away to set on top of a pyramid.
That, with what we understand as conditions and environment of humanity at that time. Now, I'm all for the idea that our concept of humanity at that time was really kind of skewed. And if it's skewed, then that opens up the possibility of definitely having the ability to move stones from a quarry, you know, miles away.
How do we know that our concept currently isn't skewed?
Our concept of what? Or
of reality is currently skewed. You said that you're willing to believe that it was skewed back then. That's
from
to
our
say that it's
from
not
our perspective
now.
Here, yeah.
So then from their perspective, ours would be skewed.
Well, yeah.
It's all relative. It's a chicken and egg game again.
Exactly. And that goes back to, you know, that goes back to the what came first. But the topic for tonight is not what came first, the chicken or the egg. The topic of tonight is as above, so below.
Yeah, which as above, so below doesn't mean. So let me define this. To try to say it some of the ways we've said in this podcast, one of the interpretations a lot of times is as below because of the way it is above.
Okay.
It's as above, so below doesn't mean as above will be as below, or as a below is because of as above. Basically, it's saying as above, so below. As and so means what is above is below.
It's like a waterfall.
What is within without what?
It's like a waterfall.
No, it's not like a waterfall, because that's applying a direction.
Oh.
It's as above, so below. The whole concept of as above and so below and as within, so without is basically says pretty is as pretty does. It's that same idea. You know, as he goes, she goes. It's that, you know, as this happens, this happens. You know, as it's not when this happens, this happens. It's basically saying they are synonymous. They happen at the same time. That one is a reflection of the other. It's like saying, who moved in front of the mirror first? You or your reflection?
Okay. I think this might actually be one of those topics that my brain can currently not really wrap itself around very well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a tricky one. Yeah, it takes having to break a really hard set paradigm of physical reality and the laws of physics.
And right now, I'm really married to my idea of the physical reality and laws of physics.
Well, I think we are all with good reason, but one of the things is that people say that there are symbols and signs that happen all the time around that come from our higher selves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how the law of correspondence, which this is called, if according to the Kybalion,
okay.
The law of correspondence, as above, so below, I think is basically saying that. If you look at signs outside yourself, they're actually coming from within yourself and just being projected into the outside world. And I think we can understand our reality and manipulate our reality when we realize that we are co-creators in this reality. Co-creators that us and the divine are creating it simultaneously by mutual agreement.
I'll have to contemplate that one a little bit more.
I gave you a workout today in the mind, didn't I?
Yeah, a little bit. This is one of those things that, you know, I mentioned briefly before we started recording that I was like, I have no idea where to go with this. Can we actually make this a topic? I'm like, well, it is a topic.
Yeah. Well, so this is one that you might be able to chew on.
Oh, yeah,
for a
definitely.
While. That. Do you think you'd be able to figure it out under a certain time?
I have no idea. This one, okay. I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's pretty out there.
So, definitely. I think this is a good place to end this episode.
Okay.
Because I don't think my brain could take much more. Because I don't know where to go with any more, you know, arguments. Like, well, no, David, I think it's like this. Like, well, what about, like, I think you're winning this one.
Oh, I wasn't trying to win it. I was trying to actually challenge just kind of presets that that, you know, we have just as human beings at this place in our consciousness.
Oh yeah, definitely. And like I said, it's like you said, to really get into this, you have to kind of break down the walls of your conceived or your perceived notions of what reality is and what's possible.
Yeah.
And right now, I am not able to let those walls go because I like them way too much. So David and I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to this episode. If this is the first time you've listened to us, we hope you've enjoyed it. If you're a longtime listener, we hope we are continuing to bring you a little bit of mind stretching. And from my personal take on this episode, my brain's been a little mushed a bit today too. So,
and if you want to see some of the things that we drew on for this brain mushing discussion, we've got all sorts of links in the show notes that I did refer to earlier in the podcast that I will be posting on our website at taketheredpillpodcast.com. Save yourself some typing and type in ttrppodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at ttrppodcast, and also subscribe to us on iTunes so that you can have these downloaded on a regular basis. And we love hearing comments. We love hearing feedback. Post feedback and comments on any of those places. You can actually post it there. We would love to hear from you.
Definitely, definitely. So for Take the Red Pill, I am Donald Dalton, wishing you to be yourself, whether you're above or below.
And I'm David Deere. Whatever it is you are, and whatever you are, it is.